So good to be with you this morning. I haven't said much about myself, but every morning I go to my office and I see patients, and one of the first things I say to most of them is, are you ready to have fun? I bet you all don't think of that when you go to your dental office, do you? But I think that dentistry ought to be fun. And I remember one time I said that in a Bible class, and one of my Bible class teachers when I was older, he said, we're not here to have fun, David. I said, Brother David back, yes, we are. Now, he was thinking of fun along the idea of, you know, playing games and that sort of thing. And I said, I just love studying the Bible. And to me, that's fun. And so, study the Bible and science, my other favorite subject, goes hand in hand. I just love that. And so, if you're here today, I don't care if you're an atheist, an evolutionist, an avid Christian, I think we're going to have a good time if you like the truth, because we're going to show some things that are absolute fact that they just don't show in the science classroom when they're trying to teach evolution. So I hope you'll enjoy seeing this material, and I know it's going to make an impression upon you because this is not presented very commonly. A few years ago, my wife and I went to London, England, and while we were there, we went to the British Museum of Natural History. And when you walk in the door, it's a magnificent hall. I don't know how tall that ceiling is, but there's a magnificent staircase that you go up, and then you turn to the left or the right, and you go up to the exhibits. And as you can see in this picture I have on the screen, we're at the bottom of the staircase, but people are stopped, and they're looking at something. And what they're looking at is a statue of Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin, the father of modern evolution. Now, the evolution didn't start with Darwin, but what's unique to him really is the idea of survival of the fittest, what people believe to be the mechanism for evolution today, from everything coming from a single cell beginning. And so Darwin's credited with that, and he is looked up to, and statues are built of him, and people talk about him with almost veneration. You take a left on that staircase, you go up to the exhibit, there showing human evolution. And you see where it says our place in evolution. And you see here the different primates with a statue of a man. And on the other side of that, you also see a diagram with the skulls of primates and showing our place as evolutionists see it in the evolutionary development of man. Now, I've also lectured at Tufts University in Boston and Boston University, and right across the river in Cambridge is Harvard University. And so my wife and I took an afternoon where we took the train across the river and went to Harvard's Museum of Natural History. And this is one of the universities that we consider to be one of the very best in our country. And some of the most noted evolutionists have put their work in this museum. And you'll notice that just like you saw at the British Museum of Natural History, there is a display of the development and evolution of humans and chimpanzees, and stating how we understand our family tree, how we have evolved from an ape-like ancestor, and the other apes and primates, as well as humans, have evolved, and how we are all related. And next to a human skeleton is that of a primate, showing how we have similarities in our anatomical development. And then again, kind of like over in London, you see the different skulls of primates and humans, and then the family tree as evolutionists have laid it out. And then you see a placard there. It says, evolution, like the theory of gravitation, is an essential truth supported by overwhelming scientific evidence. So most scientists who believe in evolution, they refer to evolution as a theory of evolution, but they really think of it as a fact that it's been established just like the theory of gravity. We all know that gravity is a fact. You take anything and you drop it on our earth, and it's going to fall. Some may fall a little slower than others. Now, gravity pulls on them all the same way, but some may have more wind or air resistance. And so because of that, like a feather, it may take a little longer to hit the ground. But gravity is going to pull them all to the ground. What we want to do this morning is we want to talk about science versus evolution. And that's kind of a peculiar subject or title for some people, because most people think that evolution is synonymous with science. Well, we're going to show you the science against evolution. But I want to begin with the Bible, because really it's an issue of Genesis chapter 1, isn't it? So most people never even look at what that says, but I want to read it with you today. Genesis chapter 1, beginning in verse 1, it says, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was waste and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light, and there was light, and God saw the light that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and there was evening, and there was morning, one day." So we see in the first five verses the description of what God did on the first day of creation. And then in verse 6 it says, "And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, let it divide the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and there was evening, there was morning, a second day." Verse 9 it says, "And God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, let the dry land appear, and it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and gathering together waters called he sees, and God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth put forth grass, herbs yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit after their kind, wherein is the seed thereof, upon the earth, and it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, herbs yielding seed after their kind, and trees bearing fruit, wherein is the seed thereof, after their kind. And God saw that it was good, and there was evening, and there was a morning, a third day." In verse 14, "And God said, let there be lights in the firmament of heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be for the lights in the firmament of heaven to give light upon the earth, and it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night, and he made the stars also. And God set them in the firmament of heaven to give light upon the earth and to rule over the day, over the night, and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good, and there was evening and morning, a fourth day." Verse 20, "God said, let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures. Let birds fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven. And God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moveth wherewith the waters swarmed after their kind and every winged bird after its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful, multiply, and fill the waters and the seas. Let the birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning, a fifth day." Verse 24, "And God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth after their kind, and it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth after their kind and the cattle after their kind and everything that creepeth upon the ground after its kind, and God saw that it was good. And God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens, over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. And God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And God blessed them. And God said unto them, be fruitful, multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it. And have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. And God said, behold, I have given you every herb yielding seed which is upon the face of the earth, and every tree in which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed, to you it shall be for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and everything that creepeth upon the earth, wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for food, and it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good, and there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day." And we'll read the first three verses of chapter 2, which closes this portion of the creation story. It says, "And the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And the seventh day God finished his work, and he had made, and he rested on the seventh day from all of his work which he had made. And God blessed the seventh day and hallowed it, because that in it he rested from all of his work which God had created and made." Is what we have just read fact, or is it fiction? Is it the truth, or is it a fairy tale? Many of our educators, talk show hosts, religious leaders will tell you it is a fairy tale, that what we have just read is not the truth. What I want to do in this lesson, the one that will be right after it, is I want to look at evolution, and I want to ask this question, is it fact or is it fiction? And I want to do it in four parts. This first lesson we're going to ask, first of all, what is evolution? When you have a debate, a public discussion, it's important to define the proposition so we all know what it is we're talking about. One of the problems that people have in discussion is they don't define what they're talking about. And in not doing that, they kind of talk around in circles. We're going to talk about what evolution is. I'm going to tell you, just defining evolution will help you see a lot you may not have considered. Secondly, we want to look at science versus evolution. A body of science that's against evolution. Then we want to talk about why not theistic evolution. Why you can't believe in God, the Bible, and also accept evolution. And fourthly, we want to look at the impact of evolution on society and the church. And it's probably greater than what most of you in this auditorium would think. It's important to look at that. So what is evolution? You know, we're not using the word evolution just to mean change in general, because a lot of things change. We're talking, when we use the word evolution, the general theory of organic evolution. So it's a lot handier to say evolution during these lectures than to say the general theory of organic evolution every single time we're talking about it. First of all, it's not a fact, as some treat it. It is a theory. It's not a fact. It is a theory that all living things have arisen by materialistic, naturalistic, evolutionary process from a single source, which itself arose by a similar process from a dead, inanimate world. This theory may be called a molecule-to-man theory of evolution. How did molecules that were dead become a living being, and that living being generate all the plant and all the animal life? That's what we're talking about when we're talking about the general theory of organic evolution. We're talking about, how do you go from atoms to getting Adam? How do you go from goo, the cosmic goo, to you? That's what we're talking about when we use the word evolution. Charles Darwin, The Origin of Species, in 1859, wrote, "It is a truly wonderful fact that all animals and all plants throughout all time and space should be related to each other." In my state of Texas, we sometimes make fun of Travis County residents. Travis County is where Austin, our capital, is. And it's really interesting how far some have gotten into restricting human beings from being able to live normally in order to protect certain things. And I could go on and on about that, but, you know, they're the tree huggers. That's what I'm talking about, because we're related to them. They think more highly sometimes of a cricket and how that cricket might not be able to breed in a certain area if you build a building. They think more highly of that cricket sometimes than they do an unborn child in the womb of a human being. Well, it's statements like this that explain it, because, after all, the crickets are our cousins. Now listen, I've got a biology degree, and I love nature, and I believe we ought to take care of this planet as well as we can. But I also believe you've got to be practical, and you've got to see the big picture, and I don't think that I really am a cousin to a cricket or an earthworm. What I am, though, is God's creation, put here like you've been put here to subdue the earth and to take care of it. That's really what it is. Now, I want to also talk about what we're not talking about. We're not talking about the special theory of evolution. Too many people confuse these two things. The general theory of organic evolution should not be confused with a special theory of evolution that simply talks about selective breeding or adaptation within a species or within a genetically compatible kind. That's a fact. That's not really a theory. We can have horizontal variation within a kind. For an example, you can take a cocker spaniel, breed it with a poodle, you get a cockapoo. You can take a Pekingese, breed it with a poodle, and you get a peekapoo. But when you bred one dog with another dog, you still have a dog, not a mountain lion, not a billy goat, and not an elk. That's a fact, though, and we've been doing this for thousands of years, breeding dogs that have certain characteristics with other dogs. So we might have a hunting dog, or we might have a domestic dog, one that will curl up in your lap and doesn't weigh 100 pounds. That's a fact. There are 200-plus varieties of bluegrass, but they're all grass. There are 300 plus varieties of perennial rye. But they're rye. They're not oak trees. We're not turning grass into oak trees. We've still just got grass. I'm told that there's some 1,300 different varieties of roses, but a rose by any other name is still a rose. This is a fact, and it should not be confused with the general theory of organic evolution. And I point this out because either wittingly or unwittingly, many evolutionists do what I would refer to as bait and switch. They talk about the special theory of evolution and say, see there, it proves the general theory of evolution. They show how you can have dogs becoming dogs and say that proves that you can go from an amoeba to a fish to a human being. And that's just not so. And I'm going to give an example of what we've all seen in our textbooks. This is a picture of the peppered moths that I'm badging almost anyone and everyone in this auditorium has seen in the past. And its story is being told about how in the pre-industrial England, when all of the trees were not covered with soot, that the peppered moths were primarily dark and white, but a lot more white because they were camouflaged. You see how the dark ones stand out on the left side? Okay? Then in industrial times, soot came and covered all of these trees. Now which one is more camouflaged? Well, the dark one. And so we have a switch of having more dark, less white. Because you see, the predators for these moths can see those better now. And then when things got cleaned up and it went back the other way, then you had more light-colored pepper moths and less dark. I hesitated there for a moment because I think about this and I have a hard time not laughing. And I'm not trying to make fun of the evolutionists, but really, when you put this in a textbook and say this proves evolution, really? How many people read this? How many people are taught this in the classroom? Go, oh, okay. That's why they put it in the textbooks. You know, if they had put it in the textbooks and you got a class of 50 college students and 50 college students stood up and said, this is ridiculous. Do you think any of us are naive enough to believe this? But that never happens. Now, you're probably thinking, why in the world would 50 out of 50 college students stand up to a professor with a PhD and say, you want us to believe this? Let me tell you what happens. A good scientist is someone who questions everything. I don't care if you're a creationist. I don't care if you're an evolutionist. If you're going to be a scientist, you need to start questioning things. How do we know this is the way it is? I'm a dentist. We even question things we have been teaching for years. I was at a lecture just the other day with an acquaintance of mine, and he was talking about the research he and some other scientists were doing on the theory of what causes tooth decay. He says, we're starting to think that what we have thought all along is wrong. And now we're thinking with our research, we're going to learn some new information that's going to revolutionize dentistry. And I'm going, boy, that's pretty interesting. Now, I could have said, you know, for the last 37 years and then 4 years of dental school, I've been teaching people about how to prevent tooth decay, and I don't want to hear anything else because I believe this to be the truth. My mind's closed. Well, that's not the attitude a scientist has. It's like, wow, Borden, keep up the research. Let's see what you find. I want to know what it is that you learn. And so you got to be willing to question everything that you believe and have an open mind. So, here's what happens in the classroom way too many times. You're told things, you're told to memorize them and then regurgitate them on a test. And you're not told that you need to think and question. So let's get back to this example. Why would anybody question this? Well, think about it. At the start, what did they have? You had both kinds of colors in the moths. It wasn't that you had all light ones and then you ended up with all dark ones or some dark ones. You had them both. Now, I'm going to tell you, even if you had all white, which is not true, and it's not the story, you can still have the genetic capacity within an organism to produce dark. But that's not the story. The story is that they had light and dark all along. So it'd be kind of like if you came to Dumas, Texas, when I went to high school. When I went to high school in Dumas, we had about 15% Hispanic population. I've always loved the Hispanic culture. I learned to speak Spanish when I was in high school, and I had a lot of friends who were Hispanic. But here's what's interesting. I went off to undergraduate school, then dental school, and I came back to my hometown of Dumas, and it was 50% Hispanic. And now it's about 77% Hispanic in the school system. Now, what do you see going on there? Is that proof of evolution? Is that not the same story that's being told here? No, there's always been Anglo people on the earth. Well, in our memory in recent past, and the Hispanic people. And what happened was you had a demographic change. Something happened in that community that brought in a lot more Hispanic people. There was a reason for them to move to Dumas and stay in Moore County and to live and to work. And we are glad that they're there. But there was something that happened that brought that in. It was called a meatpacking plant that provided a whole lot of jobs. And so that happened. And it continues to happen. See? We're not having evolution because you have a change in the culture, the change in the race, the backgrounds of people that come in. That's not evolution. And here you have the dark and the white moths, and then you end up with more dark than white, and then you end up with more white than dark. Well, first of all, you ought to be laughing about that story because you've got them both at the start, in the middle, and at the finish of the story. But that's not all. You ought to ask some more questions. You see, to us, we go, well, yeah, I can see that. Here we got the camouflage. Really? Do you think the predators, the moths, have the senses that we have in the same degree? Think about that just a little bit. Pick up a dog whistle and blow it. Who in this room will hear it? Unless there's a dog hiding under one of these pews, no one here is going to hear it. You see, dogs have ears and we have ears, but their ears are tuned differently than ours. Eyes in different animals are different. We look at a fish in the water and we think the fish is where we're looking, but what our eyes are not able to do is to accommodate for the bending of the light in the water and recognize that the fish is really a little further over than what we're looking at. Yet an eagle can be hundreds of feet up in the air, look at that fish, know exactly where it is, and dive for it and hit it right on every time because his eyes and his brain are different than ours. So just say, hey, looky here. This is obviously camouflage, is to be a little bit naive because the animals that are onto these moths are a little different than us. Then here's another problem with the story. There's only two times in recorded history where there's ever been peppered moths found on the trunks of trees. Peppered moths don't hang out on trunks of trees. They hang out on the underneath side of leaves. So here is a picture that's not very obvious in the textbook, where they have preserved the peppered moths and they've taken pins and they stuck them to a tree so they can get a picture. But then there was another time in history where a gentleman was doing an experiment and he was trying to see, what do you got to do to get these peppered moths to get on a tree trunk? Because that's not where they typically hang out. So he had some peppered moths in a bag and he'd shake them up. He'd shake them over there toward a tree and they'd fly off. And he'd get some more and he'd put them in another bag and he'd shake them up and make them sick, throw them toward the tree, and they'd fly out. Finally, he got a peppered moth to light on a tree trunk for just a few seconds and it left. So this story is just so full of error. And it's so full of things that if anybody was just thinking, you go, this does not prove evolution at all. Even if you believe everything that they tell in the story, and it's not true. Evolution's a theory, but it's not a scientific theory. And someone says, no, wait a second. Don't scientists teach this theory? Well, yeah, they do. But not every theory that any scientist says makes it a scientific theory. For a theory to be scientific, it has to be amenable to the scientific method. Every research team follows the scientific method if it's going to follow true science. I've been on more than one research team, and we sit down and consciously think about the scientific method and lay out what we think we've got to do in order to do the research and come up with good results. First of all, you've got to be able to check what's going on by observation. It must be supported by events, processes, or properties that can be observed. And it must be capable of falsification. In other words, you need to be able to come up with some sort of experiment that would prove it false. In fact, science is really more about not proving things to be a certain way. It is just developing enough experimentation, trying to prove it wrong, and when you can't prove it wrong, you feel better about it being probably right. And that's what falsification is. And nobody has been able to observe evolution. Nobody has been able to observe processes or events that support evolution. And there's no way to come up with an experimentation or an observation that would falsify it. So it's on this same basis evolution's object to creation being considered a scientific theory. And I have no problem with that because, you see, creation is not an ongoing process as evolution claims to be. Creation is a historical event. Evolutionists say evolution is continuing. One of the reasons I read Genesis 1 in the first three verses of chapter 2 was so you could see God say it's finished. It's over. Creation's not happening. It was a historical event, and it's not an ongoing process. So evolution's unproven. It's not subject to the experimental method. And if evolution is not a historical fact, and if evolution is not a scientific theory, then what is it? Well, it's a philosophy on the origin of the universe. It's a philosophy on the origin of life. It's a philosophy on the origin of life that says if you give them a frog and instantaneously turn it into a prince, that's a fairy tale. Yeah, I agree with that. But if you take the same frog and give them 300 million years, they'll produce a prince through the process of evolution. We noted this quotation where George Wald, a Nobel Prize-winning professor, said, "Time is in fact the hero of the plot, given so much time, the impossible." Professor Wald says evolution is impossible. It becomes possible, the possible probably probable, and the probable virtually certain. One has only to wait, time itself performs miracles. So evolution being a philosophy on origins, which requires miracles, is what? Is that not the definition of religion? Evolution really is a religion. And there are a number of scientists that have come out and said that very thing. Professor Louis Bonnior, former president of the Biological Society of Strasbourg and director of research at the French National Center of Scientific Research, said that evolutionism is a fairy tale for grown-ups. This theory has helped nothing in the progress of science. It's useless. Dr. T.N. Tamisian of the Atomic Energy Commission said that scientists who go about teaching that evolution is a fact of life are great con men. And the story they are telling may be the greatest hoax ever. In explaining evolution, we do not have one iota of fact. H.S. Lipson, professor of physics at the University of Manchester in the United Kingdom, said, in fact, evolution became, in a sense, a scientific religion. Almost all scientists have accepted it. Many are prepared to bend their observations to fit in with it. Sir Arthur Keith, who wrote the foreword in the 100th anniversary edition of Darwin's book, Origin of Species. Now, let's just stop to note, you don't get that privilege without being a noted evolutionist yourself. He said that evolution is unproved and unprovable. We believe it only because the only alternative is special creation, and that is unthinkable. There's always only been two choices. God made it, or it made itself. And if God made it, that means there's a God. And we need to pay attention to what God says. And there's a lot of people who don't like the rules that God has laid down. And the best way to not have the need to follow the rules is just don't believe in the real giver and believe that this world just developed itself. That's what Sir Arthur Keith said. Evolution's a religion. That is atheism. Anybody who does not understand that just really does not understand evolution. That is the reason there is a theory of evolution. Because, again, there's two choices. God made it or it evolved itself. Evolution is a religion that contradicts the two most basic laws of all science. The two most basic laws of all science, the laws that scientists have more confidence in than any other laws, are the first and second laws of thermodynamics. The first says that energy can be converted from one form to another, but it cannot be created nor can it be destroyed. These laws are recognized by every field of science, but if you're an engineer, if you're a chemist, if you're a physicist, then these laws are very important to the work that you do. Now, when you say, well, you can't destroy it, and you can't create it, well, I thought we might run out of energy. Well, that brings us to the second law of thermodynamics, the law of entropy. That word entropy means disorder. And it says that the total amount of entropy or disorder is always increasing. Now, to put it in simple terms, it's this. In any energy transfer, physical energy transfer, chemical energy transfer, nuclear energy transfer, in any energy transfer, a portion of the energy is made unavailable for further use. It's not that you destroyed it, you just can't keep on using it. You take gasoline and you put it in your automobile. Your automobile engine now has a recycling component in it, and the catalytic converter is the end stage of that. But there is a point in time where you do have to put more gasoline in your engine. You may put logs in your fireplace, but there's a point in time where you can't keep burning the same logs. Some of that energy is made unavailable for further use. So what it really says is this: the world is running down, it's becoming more disordered, it's getting worse. Evolution says, no, that law is not true. Give us time, we get this world to be better and better and better. It gets more organized. It goes against the second law of thermodynamics, and it goes against really just good common sense. You see, everything in this world tends toward disorder. Everything is wearing out. And that's what this law of entropy is saying. Evolutionists assume that adding energy, that's what they call an open system, will overcome the second law of thermodynamics. But you need to understand this universe is a closed system. When you take everything that there is in the world, in the universe, it's closed. Because when you take it all, there's nothing left. And adding energy is not constructive, it's destructive unless you've got a complex mechanism to harness that energy. You ever seen the molecule chlorophyll? That chlorophyll molecule in plants is what harnesses the sun's energy and makes food for plants. And ultimately, we benefit from that. Because that either feeds us or it feeds animals that we eat on as well. A very complex molecule. It takes a complex mechanism to harness energy so it's not destructive. You see, in 1941, the Japanese added a lot of energy to Pearl Harbor. And it didn't do anything good. It didn't organize anything. It didn't make it better. It destroyed things. And I'll just throw this out here. I believe every American ought to go to Pearl Harbor sometime in their life and see what's there and reflect upon it. And you'll recognize that there truly is good in this world. There truly is evil. And that's the way it's always been. We added lots of energy to Japan to end World War II. And it didn't organize anything. We laid those atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And they didn't get better, but they were laid flat and destroyed. The sun's energy on the vinyl top of your car is not going to make it better. It's going to destroy it. The sun's energy on the paint job of your car is not going to make it better. It's going to destroy it. The sun's energy on your house, it doesn't make it better. Give it a lot of time, and you're going to have to replace the roof. In fact, given enough time, it'll destroy the entire structure that is there. It takes human beings with intelligent minds to continue to work against this energy that's unharnessed. This is what the law of entropy says. And it's working on every one of us that are human beings. You look at Sue when she was 20 years old, but then you look at her when she's 90. She's getting better? Well, she's probably wiser. But not physically better. And then you look at Sue at 3,000, and time is not making that better. Evolution is a religion that contradicts the two most basic laws of all science. It contradicts the law of biogenesis. The law of biogenesis says to have life, you've got to have life. Evolution says, oh no. No, you can have dead inanimate chemicals and they'll produce life all on their own. Evolution preaches the false concept of spontaneous generation. You know, people up until Louis Pasteur in the 1800s believed that you could have something come out of nothing. They would look at a pond and it developed scum when the springtime would come and it'd warm up. And they just thought it happened. It's just spontaneous generation. And then you'd have milk that would develop, well, you know, it turns sour and it clabbers. And they just thought that just happened. And Louis Pasteur said, you know, I think there's something causing that. And he just understood that it was microorganisms. And he developed a process to flash heat the milk to kill most of the microorganisms so the milk would stay fresh longer. Spontaneous generation is just not true. And it evangelizes by academic peer pressure. The reason most people become evolutionists is you have all these intelligent, educated people saying it's a fact and indicating you're not very smart if you don't believe it. And who wants to be thought of as stupid? Evolution is a general postulate to which all theories, all hypotheses must henceforth bow in order to be thinkable and true. Evolution is a light which illuminates all facts, which all lines of thought must follow. That is what evolution is, according to the Catholic priest Pierre Chardin. I was doing this series of lectures close to the University of Oklahoma, and there was a gentleman in the audience who was getting his master's in English. He said, yes, evolution's even in the English department. It's in every field of thought. Richard Dawkins of Put Your Money on Evolution says it's absolutely safe to say that if you meet someone who claims not to believe in evolution, that person's ignorant, stupid, or insane. That's the message that's given so many times in our classrooms. Sometimes it's flat out said, and if it's not, it's a real strong innuendo. Hitler said, if you tell a lie long enough, loud enough, and often enough, the people will believe it. Well, it worked for him. He also said people are more likely to believe a big lie than a small one. Let me tell you, evolution is a religion that is a big lie, and I want to show you some evidence from science that shows how wrong it is. Is evolution even mathematically possible? Well, define the problem. What are the odds that unthinking molecules can turn themselves into thinking human beings? Isn't that the question? Yeah, it is. You have to first of all ask where the unthinking molecules came from. But once you have those, how did these unthinking molecules turn themselves into thinking human beings? Is it mathematically possible? Well, without looking at numbers, you can think about a mathematical type of a problem. Take all the components to a cake, sugar, flour, baking powder, and egg, and we throw them all on the floor together. How many times you got to do it to get a cake? Now, Lynn, before you came in for breakfast this morning, Jane and Gayla were working together for all these components, and they tell me when we go for lunch this afternoon, they're going to try this experiment a few times. It's a joke. Maybe not even a good one. But you know you'd never get a cake. Throwing steel, rubber, glass, and plastic together, putting them in a concrete mixture, and cranking them. How many times you had to crank them in order to get a car? You'd never have one. It takes skillful engineering, not just putting the parts together. So how much more intelligence then would be needed to design life? Brilliant scientists have failed to create life. So how could blind, stupid chance create life? It's beyond imagination. Is it mathematically impossible or possible to have evolution? Well, let's teach you a little bit about probability. Let's imagine for a moment that we'd get 200 pennies. Maybe you'd bring them from your lending institution, Mike. We have 200 pennies. We pull out a Sharpie, and we label each penny with its own unique number. We just label them 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way out to 200, so we'd know which penny is what. It's got its own number. Now, we're going to use random blind chance. We'd take the first penny, we'd put it in our pocket, and you reach in there blindly. What are the odds you can pull it out? On the first attempt, you'd get it right. There's only one chance in there. But then you put two in your pocket, and you're going to, with blind chance, try to pull them out as number one, then number two. Well, the odds of that happening in that order are one out of two, or 50%. But here's the deal. When you have three pennies, and you put them in your pocket and you're blindly pulling for them, to get them in the order of one, two, and three on the first pull is only one chance out of six. When you have four pennies, to pull them out one, two, three, and four is one chance in 24. You get to 100 pennies, and the odds of it happening are only one chance in 10 to the 158th power, and you get 200 parts. It's only one chance in 10 to the 375th power. Now, here's where I'm getting at. If something doesn't have any better chance than 1 times 10 to the 50th, scientists say it's mathematically impossible. You only have to have 42 pennies, 42 parts to get to that odds. 42 parts that have to be arranged in a certain order, and it's going to happen by blind random chance, and it's mathematically impossible to take place. Is there anything in this universe as complicated as 42 parts? You think about even a 200-part system like the human skeleton. What are the odds that it could happen? Well, in a 200-part system, we might run this experiment every second. You see? You run it every second. And someone says, you can't pull out all 200 pennies in a second and see if you got them in the right order, because you're going to pull them out one at a time. I said, yeah, I can do that with a computer and a random number generator. And I can generate randomly all 200 a second. And I run this experiment every single second. And I do it for 10 billion years every single second. And the odds of getting it right any time in that 10 billion years is only one chance in 10 to the 357th power. It's a mathematical impossibility. It's just not going to happen. And so you take even a human skeleton that's got a little over 200 parts. It could not evolve. And someone says, oh, but we're not saying a skeleton evolved. We're saying you have this one-cell organism, and it evolved into a two-cell organism, and you eventually got to the skeleton. And when they say those things, they're absolutely right, and I smile bigger and bigger because now the problem gets more complicated. Think about the human brain that has 86 billion neurons that have all got to be lined up in the right way. What are the odds that that could happen by blind, random chance? But when we talk about the single cell, and Darwin used to ignorantly say the simple cell. He had no idea what was in a cell. No idea. You know how much knowledge is being gained even from when I was an undergraduate in college to now? Cell biology is a senior level course. It's a graduate level course. And it usually takes a minimum of 2 semesters. And you have not learned it all then. Cell biology is so incredibly complicated. A typical cell has a quadrillion atoms. And Carl Sagan, the noted evolutionist, said the information content of a simple cell, using Darwin's terms, has been established as around 1 times 10 to the 12th number of bits, comparable to about 100 million pages of the Encyclopedia Britannica. A single cell, the information content comparable to 100 million pages of the Encyclopedia Britannica. What are the odds that a single cell could have evolved? Mathematically impossible. If you place bets with an evolutionist on a coin toss, and you came up with 30 heads in a row, what would he think? He'd think you're cheating. There's no way that 30 times in a row you would get heads. But then you do 60 times in a row, And if you were a betting person, I'm not for betting, I'm not for gambling, but if you were, he'd probably come after you with his gun because he'd know you're cheating. But the same evolutionist thinks that odds that are far more incredible happened absolutely. It's kind of like you went to the cosmic casino and you kept getting straight flushes over and over again. Evolution is mathematically impossible. They believe the geologic column proves evolution. I want to tell you a little bit about this geologic column. If you look in the bottom left-hand portion of the screen, you're going to see the two bottom layers of that geologic column are referred to as the Cambrian and the Precambrian levels. There are several huge problems that the evolutionist has with this geologic column. First of all, the geologic column supposedly represents a historical record of the evolutionary tree. Now, most of you have seen the evolutionary tree, how you had the single cell beginning and it branches off into grass and trees and animals and eventually human beings. The geologic column is supposed to be the historical record of this progression. Now, Stephen Jay Gould, who is a Harvard professor, he said the evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches. The rest is inference. However reasonable, not the evidence of fossils. So he says the only evidence you have is out here at the tips, the nodes, the stuff that we can see, and everything else in between, even though it might be a good, reasoned out thought, is not the evidence of fossils. Fossils do not prove those trees. Dr. Colin Patterson, a senior paleontologist at the British Museum of Natural History, said, "I fully agree with your comments on the lack of evolutionary transitions in my book. If I knew of any, fossil or living, I would certainly have included them. I will lay it on the line, there's not one such fossil." So here you have a paleontologist writing a book on paleontology, and someone questions him and says, "Hey, why don't you have these transitional forms?" He said, "Because there aren't any. If I had any, I'd put them in the book. Don't you know they all would put them in their book?" David Ropp said in the years after Darwin, his advocates hoped to find predictable progressions. In general, they have not been found. Yet the optimism has died hard and some pure fantasy has crept into textbooks. And then Dalton Batten wrote, "We have arranged the groups in a traditional way with the simplest forms first and progressively more complex forms following. This particular arrangement is arbitrary and depends upon what definition of complexity you wish to choose." You see, we assume that everything in the human body is more complex than everything else. But that's not necessarily true. Some people say the trilobite that evolutionists say became extinct about 350, 400 million years ago had an eye far more complex than the human being. Now, a lot different than ours, but far more complex. And so it's just an arbitrary definition of complexity. W. Swinton of the British Museum of Natural History said, "The origin of the bird is largely a matter of deduction. There's no fossil evidence of the stages through which the remarkable change from reptile to bird was achieved." So commonly evolutionists say, well, we get the birds by evolution from the reptiles, but there's no evidence for that. So here's a second major problem with evolutionists for the evolutionary tree. It's the actual content. Now remember, at the bottom of that geologic column, I said, note the Cambrian layer. And now books are being written on the Cambrian explosion. Richard Dawkins, avid evolutionist, avid anti-creationist, said, "And we find many of them already in an advanced state of evolution the very first time they appear. It is as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history. Needless to say, this appearance of sudden planting has delighted creationists." Even Dawkins says, when you look at the fossil record, what do you see? You see what would make creationists happy. You don't see the evidence of evolution. Richard Monastirsky said, "The remarkable complex forms of animals we see today suddenly appeared. This moment, right at the start of the Earth's Cambrian period, it marks the evolutionary explosion that filled the seas with the Earth's first complex creatures. This is Genesis material," gushed one researcher. You look at the fossil record, and it's Genesis material. Stephen Jay Gould, again from Harvard, said the Cambrian explosion occurred in a geologic moment. And we have reason to think that all major anatomical designs may have made their evolutionary appearance at that time. Not only the phylum Chordata itself, but all of its major divisions. The phylum Chordata is a group of animals that have a backbone and a neural tube. That includes you and me. We're in the phylum Chordata. And he says all of the major divisions of this phylum were present at the very beginning of the fossil record in the Cambrian level. He also said, since the so-called Cambrian explosion, no new phyla of animals have entered the fossil record. In Discovery, it was said that this demonstrates that the large animal phyla of today were present already in the early Cambrian, that they were as distinct from each other as they are today. Third problem with the geologic column is how they date that column, and we talked about this in great detail last night, so we're not going into a lot of detail. But what they do is they use a circular reasoning. They presume a date for the fossils and say, well, that fossil's in the geologic record and therefore that geologic strata is this old. And the geologist uses that as his authority for the strata and for the fossils as well. Niles Eldridge said, and this poses something of a problem, if we date the rocks by the fossils, how can we then turn around and talk about the patterns of evolutionary change through the fossil record? So let's think about this for a moment. In geology textbooks, you see pictures of stalagmites and stalactites, and they say they form at a rate of thousands of years per cubic inch. Obviously, at such slow rates, it would take a long time for them to form. Now, honestly, we don't know how long it takes them to form. What we do know is there's a process of water flowing with lime in the water, and the lime is deposited. That's what we do know. But we know it doesn't always take a long period of time. Because you can go to monuments such as this, the George Rogers Clark Memorial, and go down in the basement, and you can see stalagmites and stalactites and columns that are 11 feet tall in the basement when this was only about 40 years old. It's a lot of growth. Does that mean a long period of time? Not possible. Fourth problem for evolution of the geologic column is the process of fossilization itself. The process of fossilization requires rapid catastrophe, not long periods of time. People like to talk about fossils. They say, well, this is millions of years old because they think it takes a long period of time. This is, again, when you're in the classroom, it's time to just use your good common sense and think about what you're being told. Well, look at this quotation from Dunbar and Rogers. It says, to some thoughtful stratigraphers, this amazing discovery, billions of years, presented a dilemma. For if the known stratified rocks have been accumulating throughout this vast span of time, the average rate of depositions must have been extremely slow. Yet there's very good evidence that the individual beds accumulated rapidly. So, let's show you some examples of fossils. Here's a fossil shrimp. You like shrimp? My wife's from the Baytown area in Texas, which is on the coast, and her dad used to bring buckets of shrimp. There'd be fundraisers different organizations have, and he'd get a bucket of fresh shrimp, and they would go in there and devein the shrimp and peel them and fry them, and sometimes we'd eat them in shrimp cocktail, just, you know, fresh boiled shrimp. Sometimes they'd forget one. They'd be laying out on the counter. You ever seen a fresh shrimp laid out on the counter a few hours later? Start decomposing immediately. Here you have a fossil of a very detailed shrimp. Now, how long did it take for that fossil to occur? It doesn't have thousands of years or millions of years. There has to be a rapid catastrophe where there was some sort of process that covered it up and fossilized it very quickly. Could have been in a local flood. Could have been in a worldwide flood where sediment covers it up, pressurizes it, and preserves it very quickly. But I'll tell you something that decomposes quicker than a shrimp. How about a fern? When I lived in Oregon, there was what we call the forest across the street from our house, and in and under those Douglas fir trees, there was ferns. And a lot of times I would cut a fern, and I'd bring it home, and Mom would put it in the water. But even in water, within an hour or two, the fronds on the fern would just start curling up. This is a fossil of a fern where the fronds have not curled up. It's fresh. Some rapid catastrophe covered it up and fossilized it so very quickly. We have, I don't know how many fossils of fish throughout this world where the fish are preserved in their details. You can buy these fossils. They're so plentiful. And sometimes you can see these fossils where a fish is fossilized in the process of eating another fish. That usually happens very quickly. And here's another picture of the same thing. Fossilization requires rapid catastrophe. Someone even asked me this question last night before we went out. And I tell this story about how when people say fossilization takes a long period of time, not many cowboys would believe that story. Because you see a cow die, and if he lays in the pasture, how long is he there? There's so many predators like a coyote, like different birds, that'll gnaw off a leg, they'll chew it up. And if there weren't any of those, it'd be bacterial decomposition. It would destroy that cow really pretty quickly. It does not allow for thousands of years for this to take place. You look at a jellyfish, an animal that's almost nothing in its contents, and yet we see fossils of jellyfish, rapid catastrophe preserving these fish. So fossils don't indicate a long period of time. They indicate rapid catastrophe. A fifth problem the evolutionists have with the geologic column is the polystrate fossils. And I never saw this in school. This was never presented to me, how you can have one fossil inside fossil layers. For an example, in Cookeville, Tennessee, here is a picture taken of a 30-foot fossil tree. The top part of the tree is in shale. The bottom part is in coal. And you think about that. How did it get there? The process we believe that forms coal is this. You take about 10 to 11 feet of fresh vegetation and you squash it down, you pressurize it, and heat it into 1 foot of peat. Then you take about 7 to 8 feet of peat, and you squash that down and pressurize it and heat it to get 1 foot of coal. Now you see a tree in the coal. Don't think that tree could grow through the coal. And yet, did this fossilization taking place while the tree is there? How about a local or a worldwide flood that produced a sedimentation process on top of all this very quickly and the extreme pressures it took to produce this? That would be one theory. It wouldn't have to be the only one. But these polystrate fossils that are found all over the world, especially in coal mines, indicates rapid catastrophe. Internal evidence in the strata, however, belies these estimates. In the coal measures of Nova Scotia, for example, the stumps and trunks of many trees are preserved standing upright as they grew, clearly having been buried before they had time to fall or to rot away. Here's sediment certainly accumulated to a depth of many feet within a few years. And you talk to a coal miner and they'll tell you, these coal mines are full of these fossilized trees. What about dinosaurs? Do they prove evolution? Evolutionists say dinosaurs evolved and became extinct 70 million years before man evolved. The Bible says man and all the animals were created in the last 2 days of creation. This would have man coexisting with the dinosaurs, wouldn't it? The Bible seems to mention dinosaurs in Job chapter 40, verses 15 through 24. And there's other evidence that man and dinosaurs coexisted. In our country, down near the Grand Canyon, the Havasupai Canyon, which is part of the Grand Canyon area, they found American pictographs of all sorts of animals, including this one that looks somewhat like a dinosaur. Now, you need to understand the word dinosaur wasn't even coined about 1841. I think whatever that was, the Indians were looking at it and they drew a picture of it. So it makes you wonder, how recent have dinosaurs been on this planet? When I was in college taking paleontology with herpetology, our professor there was talking about at the Paluxy River in Texas how there had been found dinosaur footprints with human footprints. He was an evolutionist. What would you do if you're in the classroom? Would your hand go up? Mine did. I said, I've got a question. He said, what is that? I said, well, you tell us up in the Paluxy River there's these human footprints with dinosaur footprints. Haven't you taught us that dinosaurs became extinct 70 million years before man evolved? How do you get them together? Now he's telling the story. And he looked at me. He said, I've never thought about that. That is a problem, isn't it? You see, some of the smartest people in the world are not thinking. They just see, they observe, and they memorize, and they repeat it, but they're not thinking. And I said, well, now that you have thought about it, what would be your explanation? He said, well, I don't guess there is a very good one. I said, I see. And then he said, well, now that I'm thinking about it some more, maybe there was a mammal that had feet about the size of a human being. It was striding along either in front of the dinosaur, running away from it, or beside it, and laying down footprints the same time the dinosaur was laying them down. Well, I wasn't going to argue with him. But I'm just listening to that explanation. But I'm thinking, according to evolutionists, the only mammals that were living in the time of the dinosaurs were about the size of a big rat. So now you got this big rat with about a size 12 foot. And he's got a stride that's a bipedal stride, 2 feet, about as big as my stride, because that's what they're seeing. I'm thinking, you know what? It's just easier to see the evidence that human beings were in existence at the same time the dinosaurs. And these kind of footprints are in several places, but in the Paluxy River have been very prominent until people destroyed them. Pictures were fortunately taken before. I've got some friends up in Boise City, Oklahoma that are, it's a panhandle, Oklahoma. When I presented this lesson for them, they looked at that and they said, we've seen that same thing up in the panhandle of Oklahoma. And I said, well, where are this go? They said, it's been about 30 years ago. Well, they're trying to find them for me, and when we do, we're going to get some pictures. I hope they're still there or still be able to find them. We're going to end our portion of this lesson on this. Darwin gave a challenge. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed, which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Darwin says, show me one thing that could not have evolved by these modifications. Well, I think every living being proves that, but just consider the bombardier beetle. The bombardier beetle has a highly specialized defense system to repulse ants, spiders, frogs, and praying mantis. This tail of the bombardier produces a noxious, very hot chemical about the temperature of boiling water. He takes his tail and he aims it at whatever's trying to get him, and he fires it almost like a machine gun in staccato fashion. Now you have to ask yourself the question, when the bombardier beetle was evolving, what evolved first? You see, if you put these chemicals together, then you have this explosion. So he first of all has to have glands that make the chemicals, and the glands store the chemicals in separate storage compartments, and then you have diaphragms that are able to squeeze these into a mixing compartment, and then you're able to put them out the tail, the machine gun, and fire them. So what do you evolve first? The glands? Without the storage compartments? Where's the chemical going to go? Or do you do the storage compartments? So when you evolve the glands, then the chemical go to the storage compartments. But then they're stuck if you don't have the mixing compartment. So do you evolve that first? Then if you've done all of that, what are you going to do with it if you don't have the tail? You see, it all has to be fully functional from the very beginning for any of it to be useful at all. And that's the way it is with almost every living component of every living being. It has to be all there, fully functional from the very beginning, or it just doesn't work. Science, and we're going to show you some more in just a moment, shows there's no way that evolution could have taken place.